Welcome to The Next Step. The next step is figuratively, but also literally in this case, what happens after the first time. It's about figuring out what to do next in life, specifically how to manage the push-pull between ambition and contentment. Like, what do you have to do to achieve the things you want, and how can you be happy if you achieve nothing? Sometimes I wonder, would I be better off spending my time setting goals and making lists or meditating? Perhaps I should do a vision board. How do people make money and grow successful multi-million dollar businesses? Like, what are the actual steps? And are ice baths the answer to everything? I'm Catherine Collette, and this is The Next Step. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures. Jack Drews is a comedian. I think he's the best comedian in Australia. He is also, as you will probably gather in this interview, the most humble. If you have the chance to go and see his stand-up, go. I actually get super excited telling people about Jack Drews because he is genuinely hilarious and I know they're going to like him. And somehow I think that reflects on me, as if people will go to one of his shows, they'll enjoy his comedy, but the main thing they will think throughout that experience is, wow, Catherine has great taste. Not to center myself in a narrative. Jack is one of Australia's sharpest and most original comedians. He's headlined shows nationwide, including Splendour in the Grass. He's written for Channel 10's The Project and appeared at comedy festivals all over Australia. Jack released his first stand-up special, Rat Paradise, in 2022. It was featured in New York Magazine. Since then, Jack's been building a following, making high-quality sketch comedy on YouTube. Jack, a very good place to start is probably at the beginning. Was comedy part of your life growing up?
I think just trying to make people laugh and tell jokes and stuff was definitely a big thing, like in my house and my family. But I don't think like the idea of comedy as a job or as a art form really was. Like, I listen to a lot of comedian interviews and they always talk about their parents like playing all old comedy records or like stuff like that. And I don't think I was aware that that was like a thing that people did or could do. Until I was a bit older. Yeah, I'd started like doing it weirdly very young when I was at school, and there was like a talent quest thing, and I didn't really I wanted to play an instrument or something, and I just wasn't really very good at any instruments. And then I think I'd seen something on
that has not stopped most children in talent.
Yeah, yeah.
Might I say.
I think I'd seen something on TV with a comedian and I was like, oh, you can just talk, and that's fine. I'll give that a try. So I kind of started when I was like still in school, but then I feel weird saying that was like when I started comedy, because it's not like I was being a comedian then. Like, it was a thing I did like maybe once a year as a kind of gimmick. But yeah, that's sort of how I first got into it.
And what about beyond that? So as an adult, what was your first foray?
I think, again, still when I was pretty young, I got to do the Melbourne Comedy Festival does like these competitions. So there's raw comedy, and there's one called Class Clowns as well for like high school kids and stuff. So I did those and did pretty well. And I kind of thought that like, oh, this is my, it's all gravy from here. This is my ticket to the big time. And then I got to do the showcase thing called Comedy Zone, which is like just a showcase at the Melbourne Comedy Festival. I think the entry point in for me was all very like simple and straightforward through that sort of comedy festival thing. I think it's kind of a double-edged sword, because you get a lot more attention when you are very first kind of entering the market, I guess, the scene. And so I think I got probably more attention because I was so young when I was like first doing it, but I think I also wasn't very good yet. So I think that was kind of where I got into it. There was being kind of this, a bit of a novelty act, I would say, in hindsight. And then just sort of kept doing it from there, just kept doing shows every year. But I think it was a weird thing to be doing in hindsight, because I wasn't really good, but I was getting opportunities that I didn't really deserve, I think, but then also they completely you know, went away after your first few years. So yeah, I definitely wouldn't do that again. I would prefer to, if I could do it again, I would be like, just take a lot more time and get good before I did any comedy festival stuff.
That's interesting. Do you think those early opportunities were more than a hindrance, were more of a hindrance in some ways than beneficial?
Yeah, definitely. Because I think there's very little sort of interest from the industry in actually like sort of scouting talent, I would say. So I think there's like you have a bit of eyes on you when you first start and then kind of nothing after that. So I definitely wish that I was kind of a bit more, just way better when I kind of first went and tried to do those things.
Well, you're pretty good now, Jack.
Oh, thank you very much.
I want to talk about your creative process.
Sure.
So my first question, and we kind of touched on a little bit of this off air, but in terms of creating funny things, a good starting point is perhaps what is actually the focus for you in terms of form at the moment?
So definitely like writing and directing sketches is what I'm like focused on right now. So yeah, we were talking before, I trying to make a bit more of a pilot kind of thing where I've been like filming my own sketches for like since COVID really, just to have more kind of content stuff to put out there. And recently I think I just got a bit frustrated with not having enough time to make things as good as I would want to. Like I think there's so much pressure on people to keep kind of churning out content where I felt like I really want to, that's not what I like as a consumer. I like people who, you know, spend the time to make something as good as it can be. And I like writing drafts. I like doing proper edits and I like working on something and then taking some time away from it and coming back with fresh eyes. And I think that's all really important to making something good. So yeah, that's kind of what I'm doing at the moment, is just an experiment and kind of, making a sketch pilot as professional as I can.
And so for the creation of that sketch pilot, perhaps also for other types of comedy stuff you've made, like the longer form show, where does the process begin?
So I think I just have I'll just go and sit and write without really a clear agenda. Like I'll just say, that's what I'm going to do. I'm just going to go work on ideas. And usually I'll have like a few things that I'd thought about before to kind of get to build on. Like I think it's tough to just go in with like a completely blank page, or I'll have like a note in my phone from something that I thought of and I'm like, all right, let's try and flesh this out a bit more.
And how small can that initial thing be?
It can be like nothing. It can be, because I think I'm not trying to, especially with like sketch, it's really just, you kind of just need one funny idea and then the best way of executing that. So you just have like a funny sentence and then that can be a sketch by the end of the day if you want it to be. So yeah, that can be nothing. And the same with stand-up as well. Like I think I only really know how to write stand-up, and everything else I do is just sort of like some version of that, I think. Like that's the kind of process I've developed, because I think stand-up's a very, like, it's, I view it as, I think I'm much more on the writer end of the spectrum than the performer end of the spectrum. And I feel like it's just the genre in which I write is one that involves going to a bar and saying the things that I wrote. Like that's the end point of it, instead of dealing with publishers or whatever. But so I think sketch is kind of similar in that it's not like it's not endless drafts and rewrites. It's like if you want to, you can, there can be a pretty short turnaround between having the idea and producing the end content if you want to do it in that way.
And physically, what does that, you said you might have it written down in your phone, fleshing it out, are you speaking to yourself or is it physically writing down?
Physically writing down. Like I have an insane, endless like Google Docs folder, which I just kind of write stuff into. And so I'll go from sort of notes on the phone to kind of fleshing it out a bit more on there, just writing it out in kind of paragraphs or scripts if it's a sketch. And then if I'm pretty happy with that, I'll either sort of do a test, like if it's stand-up, I'll go and like test it out at a small show and make adjustments from that. Or if it's a sketch, I'll try and put it into a more like formal script context just so I can like send that to people and see if they want to do it. Yeah, that's kind of what I do at the moment. But yeah, I don't think I think you can get away with not having a super formal process if the things you're making are kind of like with sketch and stand-up, it's not like a thing where you need to keep track of all different elements of it. Like it can be a very singular thing if you want it to be. It can be, this is the joke, this is the idea, I've written it, I'll say it, done. Where I feel like if you're doing a full comedy festival show, for instance, it's kind of, maybe there's more need to like really keep track of all the different elements and how they kind of connect with each other and be aware of sort of how an audience is perceiving you and what the audience is feeling at different stages and, you know, sort of setting the tone and how the material flows into each other. And is this going to be jarring or not? There's a lot more elements where, that you have to keep track of. But yeah, it's kind of how I do it at the moment.
The audience element, I mean, that all art hopefully finds an audience.
Yeah.
But I feel like the audience element is particularly terrifying in comedy. One of the comments that you made in your newsletter was called Jack Druce's newsletter. I absolutely loved your newsletter. I wish it would come back in its COVID form.
It may do.
It was absolutely fantastic. But one of the comments that you made was, I've filled out so many marketing plans that you have to say who the show is aimed at, which is such a flawed way to start. The show isn't aimed. You don't aim art. It's like asking who your campfire is aimed at. I don't know how to aim it. I loved making it and now it's here. I really love this comment. I can totally relate. But it did make me think about the role of the audience. And I wondered, do you think an audience's laughter shows something is good, or does a lack of laughter mean you haven't found the right market?
That's a great question. Yeah, I don't know, because I'm such a snob about this stuff. So it's like, I feel like I don't really think audience laughter is always the right metric for stuff, because I think if you can...
I was hoping you'd say that, because I am curious about that as a concept.
Yeah, well, I just feel like there's so many shows that I go to where it's, you're just one of the comedians of the lineup, but it's not really your show, and the audience maybe has only been to comedy once or twice before. And the stuff that gets the biggest laughs is usually like kind of the most like simplistic version of comedy that's really not very interesting if you're, you know, if you've watched comedy like a few times a year, or if you even have kind of a passing interest in comedy, it's kind of very dull. But if the context of the show is most people aren't interested in comedy, then you can be just absolutely crushing with the most uninspired stuff ever. So I kind of feel like, and there's a lot of people where, and there's like some of my favorite comedians will go to those kind of shows and kind of just get, you know, just get crickets or just get kind of a confused, awkward laugh because they're like, oh, what are they doing? Where, so yeah, I think it's like, I think what you said about like lack of laughter meaning that it hasn't found its own audience, I think is the truer way of viewing it, because I think, I think comedy is also a strange one where there's an expectation that it should work for everyone. Like, I think when I started, I speak to older comedians and they were always sort of like out on the road or doing different cities and different markets. And the big thing that they kept coming back to was like, you know, it's gotta work for everyone. You know, you gotta be able to do any gig and get anyone to relate to it. And I just think that's so silly. Like, I just think there's no other kind of art form that's held to that standard. It's like, all right, I know we're an orchestra doing classical music, but this, you know, rap music festival has to like us. So come on, guys, let's get it together. It's like, that's just not how anything works. So yeah, I don't know. And so it's like, I think to begin with, just getting the basic skills to do it at all is most important. But then I think where I'm at now, I feel like finding the right audience is the most important thing.
You do satirise that a little bit. You have a great sketch or YouTube clip where you talk about how you're basically satirising a type of comedy, and you keep coming back to this, how Aussie is that? So you'll make a series of increasingly inane statements and sort of say, how Aussie is that at the end of it, which would potentially get a laugh, but it's working on two levels.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that specifically drives me nuts. Like, I think the amount of comedians I've seen just do exactly that thing, or like even TV shows that I've like been on and stuff, where it's kind of, because the thing I think about comedy more than anyone ever should, like more than the audience, or it's not really useful at a certain point, but like it does just drive me insane when you can do a joke where it's like, well, everyone's heard this before, and including the comedian and the audience, but everyone's still just sort of going along with it. So what's even happening at this point? But yeah, I feel like there is, do you know the comedian Stuart Lee?
No, I don't.
He might be my favorite comedian. He's a British comedian who does that a lot, and like talks a lot about comedy.
Who does it ironically? Does it ironically? Or
no, he's sort of a character in a way, but he's still sort of being himself. But he'll just, as a subject matter, he'll talk a lot about comedy and comedy industry stuff, and sort of make fun of other comedians and that kind of thing. And I've heard him talk about it, and he's saying, well, it's like, well, I've done comedy for 30 years, and all I do is go to gigs and think about comedy. It's sort of disingenuous to talk about anything else at a certain point. Like, I see comedians who have lived the same life as me, and they're talking about, oh, you know, when you go to the office and you're in the break room and there's no forks in the break room. And it's like, well, you haven't worked in an office for 30 years. So what are you talking about? Like, so yeah, I don't know. I definitely like comedy about comedy, but I just think just in the same way that people like comedy about their hobbies and the things that they're interested in and can relate to.
On the topic of audiences, from the outside, you look at stand-up comedy as an example and think, oh, the hard bit must be making jokes. But this audience element, I suspect, is equally hard, maybe harder. What do you do to win a crowd back if they're not the right crowd for you, if they feel hostile, whatever that looks like? Are there ways of winning the back? Do you just press on? What do you do in that situation?
Yeah, I think people can, like intuit very easily if someone's being kind of authentic or not. So if you're doing your act and it's clear the audience isn't really into it, and you just kind of stare into the lights and kind of plow ahead on autopilot, I think people kind of on some level know that's what you're doing. Where if you can if you can kind of acknowledge that it's not going great, or sort of engage with the crowd a bit, and you can sort of build up a bit of steam like that, I think. I don't really, there's a weird thing that happens with comedy where, because it's a mix of prepared material and also real crowd interactions or sort of real off-the-cuff remarks. And I think something happens where if an audience gets used to you just talking to the crowd or improvising or something, they'll kind of decide that's what the show is and that's what comedy is now. And then once you try and go from that into material that you've written, it's kind of like a betrayal in a certain way. It's like, what are you doing now? I thought we were just talking, and now you're going into like this pre-planned story or something. So I think there is a weird balance you can hit where if something isn't going well, it's good to acknowledge that, and that can kind of build up some momentum again. But at the same time, I feel like I think comedians are often too quick to do that. Like, they've maybe had success doing that in the past, and you can be, because often just like, I think comedians should have more sympathy for the audience at times. Like, they are often just quiet, or it's like you just finished work. It's an early show, and the first few acts were kind of not very good, and you don't really know what the show is yet. And one of the comedians was very hostile, and you don't know who any of these people are, and you're just trying to get settled in. Now the comedian's like, why aren't you laughing? What's going on? It's like, well, maybe they're quiet. Maybe they're just settling in. Like, you could probably just do your act, and they might enjoy it or they might not, but this isn't the time to kind of get in their face about it. So, yeah, I think it's just kind of an experience of thing of knowing how much to, you know, go off script and engage the audience, and how much to just kind of, you know, focus on doing your material as good as you can.
Jack, I want to come back to your newsletter. I have cut out a few quotes and I'm hoping I can get you to elaborate on some of them. So the first one is, and I think we have a lot of authors and writers that listen to this show. I think this might resonate with them. You wrote, "People think big crowds are intimidating, but that's because they've never played small crowds. The clear eye contact with individual audience members after every joke. If there are 12 people at a show and two of them start talking, you've lost a meaningful portion of the crowd. There is a real pressure to please individuals because they have so much control over how successful the show will be." Tell me more about small crowds. Are they the hardest thing to do?
I think a small crowd is sort of they're there to see you and they like you can be the most fun ever. But I think a small crowd because I think there's an assumption, like you have to, again, back to sort of putting yourself, having more empathy for the audience. If you're at a comedy show and you arrive and you've only really seen comedy on TV and stuff, and you arrive at the show and you look around and no one's there, you're really not giving it the benefit of the doubt anymore. You're kind of like, I may have made a mistake in coming to this. This probably isn't very good. It's like, you know, it's like the, I can't think of a good analogy, but just like just the setting itself makes you think, oh, this isn't very popular. I've made a mistake here.
An empty restaurant, really. Yeah. When everywhere else
exactly,
is busy.
Yeah, yeah. It's exactly right. So, and then I think that's like, it's sort of on you to kind of win them over a bit more. Where I found when I've done like bigger shows, or probably the most striking example is when I've done anything that's televised, the audience is like so like locked in from the get-go. They're like, oh, this has, like, there's no winning them over. They're like, this has to be really good. We're probably really lucky that we get to see this at all, because it's like a live taping for TV. So yeah, of course, this is the best of the best. What a treat that we get to see this. So I feel like the size of the crowds can really have a pretty big impact on what the crowd's expectations of the show would be. But yeah, I don't think if they're up for it and they like you, then it's can really be a lot of fun. Like, you can kind of chat to people more one-on-one, and like, they're some of the most fun shows I've ever done, probably. But yeah, when they're not going well, they're probably the worst ones I've ever done as well.
Okay, another newsletter comment, and I love this one as well. So you once spoke about this chess player called Garry Kasparov. Don't know if this is ringing any bells, but you'd read a book where he talks about the chess matches that he played against a computer called Super Deep. Are you recalling any of this?
Yeah, Deep Blue.
Deep Blue. I thought it was Super Deep. Deep Blue.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely has blue in it.
Yeah.
But basically the author of the book spoke about how there was this weakness in chess analysis, because when humans analyzed chess games, they had a tendency to see a story kind of play out, and there was a like a journey and there was a lesson to be learned. Whereas when computers were analyzing chess, they just saw each move as either good or bad. And you spoke about how this idea of a move just being good or bad, there not being an overarching story, could apply to comedy, but also to life. Is this a concept that still resonates?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's like, I think humans are very, like, we try and put things in the context of stories and meaning and lessons and stuff. I don't know if we do that, like, innately, or if we just sort of grew up reading books and watching TV shows where there's this kind of things have kind of a satisfying arc to them a lot of the time, where I do think that, like, I think maybe not everything is helpful to look at in terms of like it being some grand arcing thing that's going towards a conclusion or not. Like, I think in terms of I don't know, I wouldn't say I'm like know much about kind of any like Buddhism or spirituality or things, but I sort of dabble and I try to be better on that. But I do feel like in terms of just being like present and happy and just enjoying the moment, you shouldn't really, it doesn't help you to look at your life as like this this journey with, you know, like themes and goals and stuff. Like, I think you can sort of just be happy today doing whatever you're doing, and it doesn't need to be like an integral part into what tomorrow is going to look like or what your future is going to look like, or you don't have to like put a huge amount of emotion and energy into like how much your past has led to this moment. It can just be like, okay, I'm here today doing this. This is good. I really remember reading that book and writing that newsletter. I found it was really interesting. Like that, and I think it's, I might look at it again, I think now with all this AI stuff coming in, because I think that the chess world being beaten by a computer, it was like just this complete reshaping of how like that whole world, like the world of chess was. But also I think people view chess as kind of a maybe symbolic of like intelligence and problem solving and stuff. To have like a computer so quickly take mm-hmm. that over is probably pretty similar to what like a lot of industries would be going through with AI at the moment. Yeah, I found it really interesting.
Because you've taken your newsletters down. Well, I couldn't find them. I could only find the ones from the point at which I'd subscribed that had been sent to me. So I logged on to ChatGPT and said, can you give me the top 10 best quotes from Jack Drews's newsletter? Just to see, like maybe they're hiding in some corner of the internet. Like, I don't know. Anyway, it spat back all this amazing lines.
Really?
That I was like, this is incredible. And when I took them out, it couldn't find your newsletters, but it still spat out these lines saying that they were in the style of Jack Drews. That's how it was. They're in the style of Jack Drews. And I couldn't believe how funny they were. I was like, my God, these are amazing. Anyway, then I cut and pasted them because I was like, maybe these are already jokes. And they were. So there was, I cut and pasted the first one. And it was like a very famous Woody Allen quote. And then I, the next one was someone else's. So very unreliable as a method of finding old things, but
I never really I'll look into that actually, because I never really was posting the newsletters. Something about the idea of a newsletter just appealed to me over a blog. I don't know why I saw a difference in my head, but I was only doing like just the MailChimp mail out thing. So I think they do exist somewhere, but I'll have to look into that and try and do some reposts or get back into it at some point.
Do. Okay, one final newsletter quote, and like I apologize. There's nothing worse than having all of your old words repeated back to you, especially with the emphasis and things that you wouldn't have. But you wrote about, you were listening to Tom Jones and other people be interviewed on, I think it's Werner Herzog's masterclass series. Anyway. You wrote, there's something nice about hearing from people who have genuinely done their time and become the thing that they are. There's not the anxiety around trying to make it, trying to break through or bending yourself into something that could break through. I think this is kind of the sentiment that I love the most in your newsletters, this candor. I think it resonates for a lot of people who do things in the creative realm. But I wondered if your definition of making it or of success has changed across your career.
Hugely. It's very interesting, like how I think a lot of creative people get like praised for being like vulnerable or honest or whatever. But I think it's also what I found sort of strange for me is how I feel like real honesty about my situation would just be like me just being cranky about the comedy industry. And I just know that no one wants to hear that. So it's like in the stand-up capacity, really. So I find that always, I think like a lot of people who like, you can get, I don't know, there's like, it's very easy to like bend honesty and vulnerability in a way that kind of makes you really appealing to people or makes you, people want to connect with you. But it's still a kind of manufactured vulnerability to kind of like tap into that thing. Mm. Whereas I think real honesty is not often as pleasant for an audience. But that's just a side thought. Yeah, I think that, I think when I sort of first started, like I said, I was very young. So I don't think my idea of success was really like founded in anything reasonable. I just kind of felt like, oh yeah, I'm good at this. And these opportunities have come very easily. So I'll probably just, and it's fun as well. So I'll just sort of keep doing this and I'll get more and more opportunities and I'll just get a bigger audience and just get better at comedy and that'll be that. where I think, I haven't really, that hasn't happened. So I think I was pretty like, I don't know, pretty like down about my career for a long time, I think. And then I still will be on some days, but I also think that the upside of not getting that version of success means that you get to kind of pursue stuff that's a lot more interesting. Like, I think that there's people who did get closer to that version of success where you just sort of keep getting certain opportunities and you have to kind of like the quote from the newsletter saying, you do sort of have to like bend yourself into a version of a comedian that's going to fill those roles, where I think it's, you know, I think it's really good to have a long time to focus on like, well, I'm not getting these opportunities and I'm not getting an audience, but I am doing this. So why am I doing this if it's not for those things? And it's like, what's a version of doing this that really like makes me feel alive and makes me be like pumped up to do more and do better, even if no one's seeing it or if it's not getting me anywhere? Like, there's, what's a version of this that still fills me up like that? So I think that's kind of, I think if I had to think about success now, it would be to make stuff that I really love making and that sort of makes me as excited as it can, and then also like make enough money to get by. You know, I don't think I need much, but just to make enough to justify spending most of your time kind of doing this stuff would be ideal. Yeah, it's kind of where I'm at now. And I think it's like if things had gone, like I said, to your sort of initial hope of what success could be, then there's a lot of things that I just wouldn't have done either. Like, I think filming things or like writing the newsletter or working on the sketch show, working at the moment, like I just don't think I would have had the sort of self-starter like part of me wouldn't have really developed to like create my own kind of opportunities like that. So yeah, that's kind of where I'm at with the stuff now.
I'm interested. I think the creative resilience stuff is endlessly fascinating. And what I like about that response is I see that response in myself and I see that in people as they become more experienced in their careers, that shift into appreciation for what you love. And I think that makes great art too.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and I think it's like that's kind of a weird paradox is we only really see like interviews and media and books about people who are like hugely like famous and successful. So their view on all this stuff is kind of like, well, you know, is going to be different. Like, I think there's not very many like public voices of people who are like, hey, I'm just doing this for me and that's fine. Yeah, I don't know. I get very interested in that kind of like, because I think so much of like that kind of tangible like mainstream success is luck, but it's not really, if you are that person who gets that luck, it's not very fun to be like, oh, I'm so lucky. Like, you want to be, when someone puts a microphone in front of you, you want to be like, oh, you know, I worked so hard for this, even though you know there's so many people who work just as hard and didn't get the things that you get. So I think there's this weird kind of paradox where you see people get like, you see like people starting up and beginning their careers and they listen to all these interviews and they're like, I'm going to work so hard like this famous person did. And then they go longer and longer and then they see the people who kind of started at the same time they did and which one of them are getting the opportunity. And it's like this gradual, like, okay, you do have to work hard because that's the absolute bare minimum that everyone has to do. But then once you're doing that, it's still not, that's not the determining factor into, you know, who gets to have what career.
There is also, I think, a necessary self-belief at the end of the day too, that underlies the continual effort. Do you think, or for you, is there a particular thought or way of thinking that you've had to cultivate beyond that idea of success? Like, is there a way of encouraging yourself? Or,
I mean, I really like it. Like, I like doing this. I don't think I, like, there's parts of it that, you know, like, piss me off to no end. But I do feel like I'm lucky in that I don't, like, I've tried to quit comedy a number of times that I've just gotten bored and done it again. Like, kind of, I know it's not like a smart career move, and it's probably not like the most mentally healthy thing either, but I think it's like, there's really not much else that kind of, you know, interests me and gets me excited like this. So yeah, I don't, and I don't even know if it is, I think you need a self-belief to start maybe, but I don't even know if that's the driving factor. Like, I don't know if it's like, I think once you're doing something, it can be just like, I like doing this and I'm going to continue doing it because why wouldn't I? Like, I don't really see and I think there are periods where I believe in myself. Like, there's degrees to which I have self-belief. Like, I think there'll be some times where I'm very self-confident. There'll be some times where I'm not self-confident at all. And I don't really think my work changes that dramatically. Like, I think as long as if you can have the ability to not feel a great amount of self-belief, but still just show up and keep doing stuff, then it kind of levels out at a certain point, I think. But yeah, I think it obviously, it obviously helps a lot. I think when you're like feeling, when you think, oh yeah, I'm good at this and I'm doing a good job, makes it easier to keep doing stuff.
We are getting towards the end. A question on habits and routines. Do you have habits, particular routines that you found are effective, helpful for you either in your career or in life?
I run a lot. I think that's the most important thing for me. I think I definitely can track when I am running more. I feel like I'm more creative and I'm more productive as well. So that's probably the biggest one. I think I can't really do much in my house, I've learned. I need to, like, if I can go to a cafe or a library or something, I think that's kind of, like, it's kind of unbelievable how little I can do in my house. Like, it's such a, like, if I'm anywhere, then I'm like, great, let's go. And if I'm just sitting on my couch looking at the TV or the sink or whatever, I'm like, okay, this is just a non-starter. I can't do anything here. Yeah, other than that, I don't try to think of any specific. I do try and I try and journal somewhat. Like, I've never been like tremendously consistent with that, but I do like, just as a starting point, like if I have time to go and work on something, it's nice to just have the first 20 minutes of that work just be kind of untangling my brain a bit and just sort of writing whatever I'm going through.
Have you ever done The Artist's Way?
No, not really. I have read portions of it, and I think the journaling thing that I use is based on The Artist's Way. There's just this website called it's called like 750.com something. It's like, it's just a 750 words, I think, is its estimate of what 3 handwritten pages would be, and so, which is what The Artist's Way recommends, I think.
Yeah.
So if you write, if you hit the 750 words, it sort of keeps like a little calendar tracker thing of like how frequently you've done that throughout the month, which I don't think I've ever done like a full concentrated block like the book talks about. But I was talking to my friend recently who's doing it really seriously. And you know, an interesting thing, actually, you're talking about the newsletter, and I think a part of why I kind of stopped doing that was what The Artist's Way talked about with, I think it's called Shadow Careers. Does that ring a bell? And I think it talks about people who maybe want to do something creative, but that seems like too much or too frightening. So they'll do something that's kind of adjacent to that, where you're not really putting yourself in the place of vulnerability. Yeah, you're not like, I'm all in on my music, but you're like, okay, I'm going to help at this record label and maybe I'll learn sound mixing or whatever. So I'm still in the mix, I'm still creative, but you're not actually pursuing what your main thing that you would love to do is. And I kind of felt like that was what the newsletter had kind of turned into. Like, it wasn't really comedy. I think it was much closer to just a journal that I keep for myself. And so I recognized that there were people who really were enjoying it, and I think I kind of enjoyed writing it, but not always. Sometimes it was like a bit of I got to get this done because I haven't done one this week or whatever. But I think at the end of the day, I was like, I should be, I want to be writing comedy. That's what I like. And I think it's kind of that type of maybe sort of personal like thoughtful essay writing maybe comes naturally to me a little bit, but it's not what I like have ever tried to work on, and it's not really what I would like my career to be either. So I think that was kind of a wake up of like, and also it's very nice to get
It's addictive
to get positive feedback as well. So it's like, even if something isn't, it's like it's not really what you want to be doing, but people are going like, oh, this is great, I really like this, then it's such a, you're just sort of like a rat in a cage getting a treat. It's like, well, I'll do more of this then, because if people like it, then people like me, so I'll just keep doing it. Yeah, so I think that was kind of part of why I didn't do that type of thing anymore. But it's been a while since I've written anything more serious, so I would like to kind of to dabble again in something.
That's what I think is useful about that Artist's Way approach of morning pages, is that it's an effective way to arrive at those kinds of conclusions. It's sort of a way of mulling over something that you don't even necessarily know that you want to mull over.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good way of putting it. And I think it's also great to identify the things that you that your brain just kind of won't shut up about. Like, it'll be nice to look through. You look like a week's worth of stuff, and it's like, well, if you'd asked me what's bothering me, this thing maybe wouldn't have jumped out. But now I can sort of see the data here. It's like, this is clearly
that's really
occupying
true.
A lot of my thoughts. And that can either, either that's an impetus to address it, or just by the fact that you've written it out, it's almost like the relief you get from like talking to a friend about something. It's like, okay, well, this isn't just kind of on its own bouncing around in my brain anymore. At least it's kind of, I've put it out there somehow.
It moves it from subconscious to conscious, I think.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Jack, we are basically at the end. I have just a couple of quick fire questions. Some of these may work, some of them may not. The first one is, what is the best thing you've bought for under $100 in the last 6 months?
Sandals. I never wore sandals usually. And then I was in Bali with my mom, and I got quite a nice pair of sandals, very cheap. And I think just the not putting on shoes and socks before I leave the house to run errands, it's like, oh, this is heaven. I don't know why I wasn't doing this my whole life. I feel like just putting on socks to just pop down the road for a coffee or something, it seems like a crazy waste of time in hindsight. Love wearing sandals now.
What does the first 60 minutes of your day look like?
Usually, I've never been good with like morning routines. I think I'm very much a night owl. So I kind of stay up late and sleep in late. And yeah, I'm usually in kind of a haze when I wake up. I don't have like a super productive morning thing. I kind of just, ideally, if I don't have anywhere I need to be, I'll just have a shower and walk to either a cafe or a library and just try and start. Well, currently I'm doing this sketch pilot thing, so it's a lot more logistics than actual writing. So at the moment my day is I'll get up and go somewhere and start emailing people about availabilities and locations and that kind of thing.
Last one. Is social media the best thing that's happened in the world of comedy, or the worst?
I think worst. I think it's real bad. I think it's like, I think selfishly I can say that it's bad for comedy, and it doesn't really, it kind of prioritizes people making the most kind of like shocking, attention grabbing types of comedy, and just putting out values just consistency over any kind of like, I don't know, quality or charm or anything. But then I think also just as a, like, I think it's so bad for, it makes people feel so bad just as being a consumer of it, that I kind of feel bad about, even though I recognize it's the most effective way to build a comedy career. Like, I wonder if it's like just the ethics of being part of it at all, I think are questionable, when it's like, I think most people are consuming this not out of like, oh, great, this new thing I've been looking forward to. I think it's like I felt bored for a second and I had to occupy myself and I'm addicted to these apps. So, it bums me out. I don't like it.
I wish I had another question, because that's intended to be the note that we end on.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not a good.
Jack, thank you so much for today, for your for everything that you've had to say.
Oh, no worries. Thank you for having me.
You can find show notes for this episode of The Next Step at katherinecollette.com. You can get in touch via that website or via Instagram at katherinecolletteWriter.